This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Lee Nordgren of Mankato, Minnesota. He just turned 94 on September 13th, and it's been an adventurous month for him. He recently was honored at Target Field in Minneapolis, where before every Minnesota Twins game, a veteran has the privilege of raising the American flag. We're about to hear why he was honored with the Navy Cross as a 20-year-old F-6F Hellcat pilot flying off the deck of that carrier he was telling us about, the USS Cowpens.
It was well-built. As I said, it wasn't really very stable, but if you paid attention to what you were doing, and something that you have to be aware of when you're making carrier landings, you're approaching at a relatively slow speed, above stall, of course, but the carrier itself is actually going up to potentially 35 knots. Then, too, the wind can be blowing, so the relative movement between you and the carrier can be relatively little.
Yeah, you talk about finding a moving target. I'm sure that was an acquired skill that you needed a lot of touch for. Well, after waiting so long to get out there into this action, and you said you felt a moral obligation to follow up on all the training you'd received, tell me about your first time, your first mission flying off the deck of the Cowpens.
Well, actually, the first mission that we experienced was at Wake Island, and the Japanese had taken Wake Island the day after they attacked Pearl Harbor. It was told to us that the Japanese had a lot of practice, that everybody that went by there attacked them, so that we should be cautious. And tragically, the first loss that we had was an Ensign Pettypaw, who left a wife at home expecting a baby in 3 months. And which is why I had engagement and marriage rings for my wife, Donna, that I didn't give her until after the war, when we then officially got married.
I'm glad you brought that up. So that's an important chapter that I don't want to leave off. So we'll get back to the Cowpens. Tell me about Donna. How'd you meet her?
As a matter of fact, she was a high school junior when I was a senior. The newspaper for the high school was part of a program that we both got involved with in writing articles, and that's how I met her.
So you meet her in high school, then you go in the Navy, and you're still pretty sweet on her, and you're thinking this is the one?
Oh, yeah, I was sure. In fact, when I was at St. Mary's Preflight School out in California, I was very fortunate to stay in good, healthy condition. And I was, out of the 100 cadets in our particular unit, I had the first place in the obstacle course, which is shortest time. And that gave me the choice of the next base that I should fly on the Stearman, which was a biplane, open cockpit biplane. And there were 8 of them on the West Coast, the bases that I could pick. And there were 2 others. And I chose Hutchinson, Kansas. And everybody says, the wind blows there all the time, and it's a dry state. Well, didn't bother me about dry state. I didn't drink that anyway. But when I went to Hutchinson, then I got 4 days at the end, a day going home to Minnesota, visiting with my folks in Donna for 2 days, and then a day back before I then had to go to my next base.
Is that when you asked her if she would marry you?
No. Right now, I don't remember the specific day that I asked her to marry me. I know I was at the Topic Cafe with her when I asked her to go steady, and that was in the spring of 42. But I didn't want to get that deep into it because I thought, well, there's going to be some pretty girls that I'd like to dance with when I'm out and around, too, if we travel. And I didn't want to restrict her either.
But you mentioned you had the rings and everything. So everything was in order, but you two had a conversation about it to decide to wait to see if you made it home?
In fact, I had stored with Mrs. Engesser, who was the jeweler right next door. And in fact, when Donna found out that they were there and I hadn't offered them to her, she was a little irritated with me.
So how'd you leave it with her when you went overseas?
Well, the kiss and the hug and a goodbye. And she actually came out with my folks and my younger brother to San Diego to say goodbye, and was very cordial. And I remember at the time that I said, Mom, Dad, I'll buy you a drink. And my dad said, you aren't old enough to buy a drink. And I said, oh, yeah, I think it works. And I took him down to the bar in the basement of the sophisticated hotel. And the gal at the door took a flashlight and shined it. She says, well, when you can take the piece of paper that says two on there and off, and it's legal, I'll be happy to let you in. But until then, goodbye. My dad laughed all the way up to the hotel room.
Well, you mentioned not being able old enough to buy a drink. I guess I didn't ask you how old you were when you flew your first mission.
Well, I had really thought about that, but again, I was a minor yet.
So your first mission was in 45?
In 45, yeah.
So you would have been 20.
Yeah, 21 is the age for acceptance on there. And that was at Wake Island. Then we went on from there. That's when we joined the four other carriers between Wake Island and the Philippines. Then we went on to Japan to attack almost anything that moved. If it sailed or, and I know I shot up a steam engine on a train, and it almost took me out when it blew up. And there are other things like that. Anything that looked perishable that we could make the Japanese uncomfortable with, we attacked. I never shot at people directly.
Well, you mentioned that shooting at a steam engine, and when it blew up, it almost took you out. I think I need to hear more of that story. So you're diving with other Hellcats and strafing things, and that's what you were strafing?
Yeah, you go to an area and you rendezvous and attack a certain territory together, and then you join up again and come back to the task force. If you tried to come back alone, you could easily get shot down by the people who are protecting the task force. So you have to be careful about that.
You mean your own guys?
Right. Yeah, because the Japanese, if they could get a Hellcat to run, they'd try to get in to attack there. We had kamikazes attacking all the time, but they were flying mostly ineffective airplanes.
But you're saying if they had a Hellcat that they found that they could get in the air, they would try to crash it into an American ship. So if you're coming back from a mission solo and they can't identify you, they're going to shoot you down.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, that was the hazard on the day that my flight leader and I attacked Curry Harbor on the 25th of July. And we were the only two out of the 200 that were in a cave in the clouds. The planes were milling around in there. No more than two airplanes together. It was so crowded. We lost our second section. A division has four planes in it. It's two sections.
Well, let's talk about that day, July 25th, 1945. It's only a couple weeks before the atomic bombs would really change the war and bring it to an end. You said 200 planes went out on that mission?
There were 200 airplanes inside this cavern in the sky. Part of them were to protect the task force. The others were to attack as they did the day before. Curry Harbor was like Pearl Harbor was to Americans. And it was well fortified and ready for any action that people would not want to get involved with. So when we broke out of the clouds after flying for about 45 minutes west into Japan, we saw the Issei battleship off to our right. And that was identified when I fired my 50 caliber machine gun for psychological reasons. When I was attacking, coming down, it recorded it on film, because when we came back from Curry Harbor after attacking, people said, where the hell have you been for the last hour and a half? And we said we were at Curry Harbor, and they all said both until the next day when they saw my film.
All right. So I just want everybody to understand the big picture and the context here. You said Curry Harbor is like Pearl Harbor, and what you meant by that is there's a large concentration of Japanese forces, and it's very well defended. So if you are going to go attack that, you'd probably want to have strength in numbers.
Yeah, you spread out the people firing at you. In fact, after I dropped my bomb on the Issei, I stayed low to the water, figuring that if they aim at me that low, they're going to have to go across the bay and shoot at each other, too, while they're firing. But my flight leader got up there where he should have been shot down right away. And for no reason at all, he got away with it.
Well, and I'm sorry for bouncing around with you, but I don't want to leave out some important details. One of the reasons you were decorated with the Navy Cross for this mission, for this incident, is that you kind of weren't supposed to be there. And nobody else was. It was just two planes out of the 200?
The irony of that is that we had specific orders to jettison our ordnance that was proper to get rid of before you came back to your carrier. Because they don't want bombs and rockets flying down the deck on a carrier.
And that was because the weather was bad? They told you to abort and come back and jettison your ordnance?
Yeah, the weather was bad so that they couldn't get out of that stormy cage. There's just no way. And yet my flight leader chose to do that. He wasn't a very good instrument pilot, but I stayed on his wing, and fortunately we got to Curry Harbor and back.
So the rest of those 200 planes obeyed the order and returned, but your flight leader, Dotson, decided we're going to go after some ships?
Yeah, he said, I want to, on a separate channel, he said, I want to hit a target of opportunity at least. We went west and didn't break out at all until we came to Curry Harbor.
And I realize you don't have a whole lot of time to think about it when you're up there in the sky in your Hellcat and your flight leader has made that call. Was there a moment where you said, should I go back or should I follow? And how'd you make that decision?
Well, when you're a wingman, your responsibility is to your flight leader. And so I had no problem with that. I figured that if he's made a mistake, I'm just sharing the mistake with him. The interesting thing was, after we came back from the attack, our PR people discussed what should be done with it, and they decided that some metal just beyond the air metal, which isn't very high, we should be put in for. And lo and behold, it came back with the Navy Cross. So I think they were being more kind than they should have. We should have been dead.
Well, yeah. So I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're a 20-year-old kid from Minnesota who's out here in the Pacific flying in this horrible weather. Your flight leader decides to ignore a command, go on with the mission, and try to do some damage. And you don't want to let him down as his wingman, but as you started following him toward who knows what, did you think, I don't know if I'm going to get back to the ship at all? This may be it for me?
Well, one of the problems, too, is that I didn't have the equipment operating that permitted me to come back to the carrier task force and know what was the proper area to approach the task force from so that I could be in jeopardy for being shot down by my own airplanes. YEZB, I think is what they called it. The YEZB. If it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you had to come in from 50 degrees. And at another time of the day, you came in at a different angle to the task force. And while it was all general, it still gave them a chance to decide whether they wanted to shoot you down or not.
And a second ago, you made a very blunt and direct statement. You said we should have been dead. Help us understand why that's the case.
Well, when you have a whole bunch of people that are angry at you and they all have guns and they're all shooting at you, the chances are that someone is going to hit you. And the fact is that neither one of us got hit. And that's why they didn't believe us when they checked our airplanes and our airplanes were clean. But when they saw my gun film, they knew that we'd been there.
So, and I'm sure this is a day, that July 25th of 45, that you've thought about quite a bit since then and probably replayed in your mind a few times. But if you can, take us from the start to the finish of that attacking run that you and Dotson made on those Japanese forces.
Well, as we broke out of the clouds, I pulled my plotting board out and looked, and I said, we're at Curry Harbor, and that's the EC battleship over there. He said, right, we'll spread out and attack. And you take the port side, and I'll take the starboard side. And that's what we did. And I can remember going down, diving down on the carrier, is that when I fired the machine guns, which is not going to do a whole lot to a battleship, it would make some noise, but it also recorded what we did. But it also then pulled my shoulder straps down. And here I'm at probably diving at 60 degrees, and it actually slowed the airplane down. There's 6 50 caliber machine guns in the wings. It slowed me down.
Just the force of them firing?
Just the force of them firing.
So you're firing on your way down, and there's probably some other stuff coming back up at you.
Yeah. Oh, I said partway down, I said, Dodson, they're shooting at you. And he said, hell, look behind you. I didn't. I didn't have an interest in knowing what was back there. It wouldn't help anything anyway.
What's your guess?
Well, if it was like it was behind him, it would be a mess.
Anti-aircraft fire exploding behind you?
Yeah, just anti-aircraft were firing. There were no Japanese planes in the air at that time. None.
Probably a good thing.
Well, yeah, if there'd been some fighters there, we'd have had some additional problems. Then they'd have to cut off firing at us in order for the planes to attack us, too. So it gets complicated for them, too.
So you make that dive on this battleship, and then you drop a bomb or no?
Yeah, we each dropped, we just had 500-pound bombs, but we dropped our bombs on the ship, and we had hydrostatic fuses, which means that they go down into the water a few feet to get below the protection area, and then they explode, so they're a lot more effective that way.
So you dive on the battleship, and then you pull up, and then what?
Well, I didn't pull up. I stayed right down on the water. I thought that if they wanted to shoot at me, they'd also be shooting at each other, people on the ground. But my flight leader pulled up where he really was a prime target and should have been shot. But I caught up with him just before he got back into the clouds. Otherwise, I'd have had the problem of getting back to the task force without getting shot down by our own people.
So what was the result as far as damage inflicted?
I'm not exactly sure. The battleship, the EC, was moored there, so we weren't sure. Supposedly somebody had said it's a foot lower in the water, but I don't know whether that was blarney or not.
So you have to catch up to him to make it safely back to your ship, and then you guys do make it back to the cow pens, and the reaction was?
Well, like I said, with using profanity, then I won't do it again. They didn't believe us until they saw my gun camera film. And that verified the Issei battleship, which was the only one that was left. Only Issei-style battleship.
What was it like for you to see that gun camera film?
Well, it wasn't a surprise because I had fired it, and gun camera film had been working for me on other targets, so it just confirmed it. But it was in the ready room. They ran it for the other pilots to see, too.
And I wish we could watch that film now. I don't have that, but you will find photos and a short video of Lee Nordgren at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I'll read his Navy Cross citation for you when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.